All right. One of the first things that we ought to do when we investigate a claim that's made on something as important as whether we are actually handling God's Word when we read the Scriptures is to examine it to the best of our ability whether the claim that's made is actually possible. Now, with the claim regarding the Scriptures, that would mean starting just with the question of whether if someone had a message from God, we'll say, could that person have written it down, and could it have then been read and preserved and so on? In the question of the origin of the Bible, of course, there are two claims made. One is that the message that came through the prophets was inspired, that God inspired it, that God breathed it. That claim we have to examine on other grounds too. But the claim that message that claimed to have been from God could then have been written down and read, we can examine on other grounds. We can examine on the basis of history and what has been learned, especially in the last 150 years, about the origins of writing and language and so forth. And there's so much evidence available in these fields that I think it's really astonishing in a lot of ways. If you have with you the outline that we used last week on the written word, let me just remind you that after we pointed out that God confirmed His word at the time He gave it, and then that He revealed it in settings where writing it down was possible, we tried to examine writing materials for a while. You guys remember we discussed or tried to point out that these writing materials ranged from a material made out of plants, which you might remember the name for it,
papyrus,
to clay tablets, soft clay tablets that were written on and then baked, to ordinary things like pieces of pottery or wax-coated tablets, to more permanent things like stone even, or engraving in rock. All of those and many other kinds of materials were available. And then, as time progressed, which one became the more permanent or the more expensive and usable type of material? All right, parchment, somebody mouthed the word there, and that's that gives us some idea of what we're dealing with. Now, when class ran out last week, I pointed out that in order for writing materials, pens and other and materials to write on, for those things to be of any use at all, we have to have one other step made in this development, and that would be we'd have to have alphabetic writing. Alphabetic writing is the kind of writing that would be necessary to communicate and to preserve specific ideas. Concepts could be communicated by means of pictures, like hieroglyphic and that type of thing. But for ideas, like what a person is thinking and what God wants, alphabetic writing is necessary. And that's number 5 on that paper that I gave you. And just to follow the line of thought here for a minute, let's kind of start where we are and think back about this is a lot more crucial point than maybe it strikes us at first. To start with our own alphabet of 26 letters. We could sing the alphabet song, but I want to assume that we all at least know the words to that song, if not the tune. Our 26 letters, we actually inherit or borrow from the Roman alphabet. The Romans were using, by the way, when I say Roman alphabet, what language would we be talking about?
Latin.
All right, Latin, obviously. The Roman alphabet had 23 letters to it, many of which we borrowed. Our I and our J are just variant forms of one Roman letter. And if you see the inscriptions in Roman, then you notice sometimes the old printing, you'll see the variations of this. And then our U and our V are also variations of one Roman letter. Sometimes if you see the inscriptions, you'll see the U, what we would call U, would be written in a V. I wonder why they would ever have done that.
Easier to make a point than a curve.
Yeah, all right, exactly. It's easier to make an inscription in a point than a curve. You'll see the same thing with I and J, right? You can see that kind of thing. Our W is also a variation of a Roman letter. In fact, it's just what we call it, a double U. Two V's together, if you think of it that way. So we take this back, of course, at least to a century or two B.C. What we learn, though, is that the Romans based their alphabet on the alphabet of the Greeks, who lived in the southern part of Italy at least as far back as the 8th century B.C. The Greek alphabet can be taken back at least that far. It had 24 letters, and I've given you a little bit of information about that. The Greeks devised their alphabet, we know now from archaeological discovery and so forth, from the Phoenicians. And the Phoenicians were the people who simply lived along the Mediterranean in this region here. Maybe just to the northeast of what became the land of what we know as the land of Palestine. The Phoenicians had the key change here is that their language is more of a Semitic language. And can anybody... what I mean by Semitic, not only the form of the letters, but also the fact that instead of vowels being included, the letters are all consonants, and vowel sounds are made in other ways, and it is a more guttural language. For example, if you hear someone speak Hebrew today, the gutturals will be the sounds that are made, the K's or G sounds that will be made from deep here. They're different sounds than we commonly use in Arkansas, at least. So you notice accents, like in German uses this idea a little bit also. But anyway, it had 22 letters, and in its earlier uses, one of the distinguishing facts about the Phoenician alphabet was that normally it was written from the wrong side. I mean, you start over here and write this way in Semitic languages ordinarily. All right, we can go back even farther. What's called cuneiform. You guys have heard of cuneiform. Don't let it confuse you. All that means is that it was a wedged shape. Alphabet or a wedged shape writing form, which happened because they used for writing material soft clay, and they used a stylus or an instrument, a metal or type instrument that had a triangle shape end to it, and so when you press that into the clay and pulled it to make a letter, it would come out to be a wedge shape. In other words, where you started over here would be a wider place than where you ended over here. That's all cuneiform means. And cuneiform script was used by the Sumerians. The Sumerians were, notice on the map up here, Sumer, right here. We would hear it later on called Mesopotamia. But the Sumerians, the predecessors to Iran, Iraq, maybe, and those peoples, were writing in this form farther back than 3000 B.C. at least. Now, when did we say Moses lived? 1500 BC. So what do you notice already about writing just from what I've just said?
It's well established.
All right. It had been in use a long, long time before Moses lived. The Egyptian scribes, who also used the kind of hieroglyphics that you guys have seen pictures of from the pyramids and so forth, also developed a form of an alphabet of 24 signs. By the way, an alphabet means that there is a symbol for each vocal sound in that language, whatever language it is. That's what we mean by alphabetic writing. And obviously, once you form a symbol for any sound that you can make, either a consonant sound or a vowel sound, then the flexibility for the ideas that can be communicated really increases exponentially over what you could communicate with pictures. In other words, Egyptians were doing this also before 3000 BC. All right. Now, what we've said seems like a simple thing, but I've just tried to point out to you that the idea of writing things down happened early on. The materials that could be used for this were available very early on, preceding any of the books of the Bible, and the alphabet to be used in doing this were available very early on. Now, how could we know that? How do we know that? How do we know that what I'm telling you here is not just, I didn't just make it up?
Discoveries.
All right. How could they do that? Archaeological discoveries is that is the fact. But how could they do that? Some of the kinds of materials that they wrote on would last, and the places where they lived made the materials last even longer. They're places of interest which have been excavated over time. And then often, some of these discoveries that have been made, the so-called Rosetta Stone or the Moabite Stone or some of the prisms of ancient kings who were real proud of themselves, they inscribed, like if a prism had three sides, each side would have an inscription in a different language of the people that they had conquered. And therefore, if some of these languages, say ancient Phoenician or whatever, we could just say, nobody really knows what those words mean and so on. Well, if you discover something that has three languages on it telling the same story, what possibility does that open up?
Translating it.
All right. Whatever you were unclear about may be clarified by the other things on that stone. For example, it happens that Roman, and this is why I wrote this up here, Latin is so similar to English that we can decipher what Latin is about. It's been a commonly used language. But if that came from Greek, then we can figure out what Greek means. If that came from the Phoenicians, we can figure out. And if the cuneiform was used, say, in some of Ashurbanipal's inscriptions or Sargon II's inscriptions and so forth, then we can figure that out and so on. And that's what's been done. So, okay. So
Claire's told me when he went to the Bible lands and went to the Dead Sea Scrolls and those caves, that you even had pottery that was how they lived.
Yes.
Correct. And how the water got into those where they could survive down in there, mm-hmm. and where they could make their copies, etc. And the temperature was just right. So
right.
Everything like that.
A museum couldn't have preserved it.
They
any
do
better.
It now.
Yeah, they do.
They
now.
Have got the temperature thing now to put them in it. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Humidity and etc.
Right.
I didn't see it. I'm just going on hearsay.
I haven't seen it either, but that's what everybody says. So I think that Brother Feeney's telling the truth about this. It's not like Barney and my fish. But that's the idea. God did this at a time and in a way where the preservation of the message would be guaranteed by the nature of the case. And that's a thought-provoking thing in and of itself. Now, go another step with me here. Number six. If there were writing materials and an alphabet, anyone who knew the language could learn to read and write. Now, I have done that. We were not noted in Baxter County for linguistic skills, but I can read and write. And have you ever noticed in a passage, let me just point out something to you. Judges 8 and verse 14 is one simple example of this in the Bible. The time of the judges happens at least 1250 B.C., for example, and you would think, well, this would be, reading and writing would be a luxury for only the wealthiest and most famous people. That may be an assumption that a lot of us share, but it's wrong. Look, for example, at Judges 8, verse 14. You can read the whole context to see the point, but this involves apparently a common young man. Look what it says. Somebody want to read for us?
And he caught the young man of Saka and broke down for him the officials and elders of Saka, but 77 men.
All right, now, in other words, they're in battle with Philistines and others. There's a certain town there that needs to be taken. And so the judge catches this young man and has the young man to do what?
Write down
the names of the officials of this city, the people that need to be caught and held responsible, right? So I find it interesting, reading and writing was available enough that that could be done. And so we just go from there. Now, just take a minute here to point out the languages of the Bible. This is common understanding to most of us, but the language of most of the Old Testament is what?
Hebrew.
All right, it's Hebrew. For almost all of the Old Testament. Hebrew, of course, is the language of the Hebrews, and it's very similar to the Semitic type language of the Phoenicians that we mentioned earlier. I brought the Hebrew Bible with me. Now, obviously, written on a scroll or papyrus or whatever would not be this way, but gives us an idea. It starts, like I mentioned, from the wrong side. Here's Genesis. And you notice something very right away about this type of language. What? What is it? Notice the one over here? But do you see any similarity with English in that? Nobody in particular is writing in English.
That's upside down even.
All right. Hebrew is all... It's unfamiliar and strange to us because there are no letters that we share with it. And you notice that the shape of these letters is all a certain type of script. And if you think of this all written together with no spaces in it, and you remember that all of these are consonants, not any of them are vowels. The vowels are little dots and points and accents that really were developed by scribes known as the Masoretes about 1,000 years after the Old Testament in order to make it possible for us to name these. But it's Breshit Bara, Elohim, that's the in the beginning God created. That's the idea of this type of language. And that's the language of most of the Old Testament. Now, the second type of language in the Bible is also used mostly in the Old Testament, but it's called Aramaic. And Aramaic is nothing other than a form of Hebrew that developed during the period of the captivity and the exile. And the Aramaic is the language maybe that would have been spoken by people like Daniel or his contemporaries who lived away from Jerusalem and away from the temple and so forth. And hey, Monty?
I was curious on the Hebrew. Do they read from right to left?
Yes.
Do they read English left to right?
Yes. We read English this way, but Hebrew is still read from this side over this way.
Japanese is up and down?
Japanese is up and down. And some of the languages that I mentioned here were originally written in up and down. In fact, cuneiform is an example of that.
It looks perfect if you turn it upside down, the book. It looked like it had the ending down on the bottom and
yes,
there are little briefy things at the top of a paragraph.
If you can imagine, like some of the letters, we give you an idea. The Hebrew letter for our B is called Beit. And or Beth, as we would read it in Hebrew, or in English, and it looks like the door of a house. Looks like a house with an open door. Guess what the Hebrew word for house is? Beth. That's right. Beit, as they would say it. And if you ever, so I take it that they got some of the letters and words from the things that they saw. It's an interesting part of that. All right, Aramaic. There are some Aramaic terms in the New Testament. And I could mention some of them to you, for example. We would say it in English, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. Where's that said? That's Aramaic. All right, Jesus on the cross. Or Abba is Aramaic. What does Abba mean?
Take care.
All right, it's the name for a father, the name a child would call a father. So there are a few terms like this in English. And then the entire New Testament, other than those few terms, is written in what? All right, in not just Greek, but it's called Koine Greek, and the word here is written like this. Koine Greek means the common Greek, the kind of Greek that an ordinary working man would have spoken. And the reason I mention that is that there was a time again when the critics said this kind of Greek was not spoken. This is not like classical Greek. And it turns out it was. It was the language of everyday business and the language of letters and so forth. God made himself known in the language of the ordinary man. And Greek looks a lot more like our English. Now, this is written in small letters. In fact, I'll pass it around if you guys want to do that. And if you can imagine these things being written in capital letters and no spaces between the words and so forth, that would have been how it might have looked as people wrote it originally. But Greek is a beautiful language and very specific language. Not just the number and the person of the words like we would use yours, mine, and ours or something like that, but also the gender of the word and all that kind of thing is very specifically identified in each term in the Greek language. God chose a language where he could make his will known in a very specific way, and it could be examined and studied in a really interesting way also. All right, so.
So that made it really important then when Peter stood up with, didn't it?
It did. Very much so.
It made it much more than us just trying to understand
right.
Spanish.
Let me comment about what she just said, Monty, just a second. We'll get to you. The point that Sister Feeney just made is really crucial because, you know, like in Galatians 4, God sent his son at the right time. Galatians 4 and verse 4. At the fullness of time. Thank you. And one of the ways it was the fullness of time is there was a time where people could travel because of the Roman roads, and there was relative peace in that part of the world because of Roman armies and government, but people could communicate because the entire civilized world used, in one form or another, Greek as a language to write and so forth. And so the ideas could spread, and did. Now, Marty, you had a...
I think what I was reading years ago was that the English language is a living language.
Yeah.
It changes ever so often. And the Greek was still a dead language, what this reference material said. So I was wondering if that's still applicable.
Well, I heard just this past week, in fact, how many words are added to the English language every day. And I'm sorry, I can't remember how many it was, but it's a bunch of them still. Both Hebrew and Greek are sometimes referred to as dead languages in the sense of the language you use in biblically, but they're both languages still in use.
I meant basically they don't change. Because I was thinking of scriptures itself,
right,
once you read it.
They can, right, you're right. They can be examined objectively, yes.
One of the things you don't want to say when you go to Greece is you have a dead language.
Yes. Well, it may not be exactly the same form that's used in the New Testament, but definitely it's still used. But your point is that biblical language is the language of a time and a place which can be studied objectively.
Thousands of years.
Right. Because how I use it now, I can't go back and say that's how it was used then. I have to discover how it was used then.
How God makes the universe and all this function, then if you just believed how he made people to communicate...
Mm-hmm.
That would be enough to believe in God.
That's a profound point, right? How did we get to this ability? And that's really a thought-provoking thing.
Notice we left the Egyptians out there.
Yeah, I didn't mean to. The last point I had on the deal about the alphabetic writing was the Egyptians, and I just mentioned it briefly. The Egyptians... Besides the alphabet that some of their scribes developed that was not used widely, did widely use written language to communicate. Their more popular form of writing happened to be the more familiar one to us, which is hieroglyph. And they used it extensively. And I didn't go into that further because I was interested in the connection with the Phoenicians here. All right, any other point? Let me just ask you to notice that on that outline, number 7, I point out something that is instructive to me, at least encouraging to me, and that is that we may regard it as by the providence of God that as he was ready to make his will known, the entire process was furthered in some rather dramatic way by these 5 things I've mentioned there. One is the fact that the materials and the languages and the alphabets were available when God was making himself known. B, the fact that this ability to read and to learn to read or write or understand was not limited just to trained readers only. Now, obviously, it was before the days of the printing press, so common people didn't have the ability to maybe go to bookstore, Barnes & Noble, and buy a book or whatever. But people were familiar with the process of writing and reading and understanding. See, the political conditions that existed pretty much guaranteed that what was written would be spread. Now, I mentioned a while ago something I don't want you to just let slide by. When, say, a king from Babylon over here or Assyria would, you know, we studied as when we looked through the period of the kings a while back, the back and forth that this entire land, part of the world, experienced during those days. When a king became the predominant one or the strong one, he took over and he won battles or conquered territories, one of the ways that he maintained control was to make the record of his exploits known. And so he would set up inscriptions, or he would record his campaigns on stone and so forth. And he'd do it in different languages. And that pretty much guaranteed that somebody was always going to be able to remember him and understand what he'd done. And that turns out to be a way in which we can know what these languages mean and where we'd be prepared to understand what God has said to us. And then the climates that are mentioned. Sister Feeney mentioned where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found and so forth. But a lot of, there's a place in Egypt, Ras Shamra, where, and also another place, I don't even know how to spell, say the word, U-G-A-R-I-T, where thousands of tablets have been found by archaeologists, and a lot of them were written on papyrus, which there would have been no way in the world for it to have survived anywhere else in the world except where it was found, because of the humidity level and the natural conditions that existed. Is that a coincidence, or is that God, the providence of God at work? And then this is all done in places that would be investigated and excavated and examined by every generation following. And I noticed when I try to do some reading about this, and a lot of the pictures that I can find about these materials, a lot of them have been found, a lot of things new in the last 15 or 20 years that really shed light on the land and places of the Bible. All right, that's a little bit about the...
And that's the reason we want other countries to speak English when they come to the United States, because if they want to be here, they ought to speak a little English.
That's one reason. It's interesting, the Romans used that policy to not English, obviously, but the common language to bind their empire together. That's one of the reasons why they popularized Greek and used it even further. All right? Any question or other comment or observation about the part of this story that we've just worked our way through? It's not an exhaustive study at all. Anybody? All right. The Bible claims to be a message from God that he had written down. There was writing material and alphabets and language in use that would have made that possible. All right, that part we have settled. Now, look at your other paper for just a minute. We won't get too far into this. I've not left a bunch of blanks on this one for my own reasons, but I want to point out to you two interesting things that you run across. If you just start reading through the Bible, you run across these things right away. One is that the things that were written immediately began to be kept. For example, in Deuteronomy 31, verses 9 to 11, Moses writes down the words of the law in a book. And you remember where he had that book kept?
Beside
the Ark of the Covenant. And what was the purpose of that book? All right, it was to be read as a witness to the covenant that had been made between God and Israel. Now, also you notice that these materials that were kept were consulted by succeeding generations to find out what God had said. For example, Daniel 9 and verse 2. Daniel had been reading somewhere that the captivity would last 70 years. Now, where could Daniel have read that? There's only one place. Where could he have read a message from God that the captivity would last 70 years? All right. Only from Jeremiah. All right. Now, Jeremiah was like a generation older. They lived at part of it at the same time, but when Daniel was a boy, Jeremiah was already a grown man doing the work that God gave him to do. So we're talking about two different generations. But how did Daniel, over here in Babylonian captivity, learn anything about how long the captivity would last? He read what the prophet Jeremiah had written. All right? Or you find a similar kind of thing happening in Nehemiah 8 and verse 1, Nehemiah and Ezra. Now, that's not a surprise. I would expect that if something was from God, it would be written down and kept. How many of you have letters somewhere that you've kept?
All right. Good.
They may not be anything other than crayon messages from your kids, but you have that somewhere. It did. Let me just real quickly mention the other side of this. The other side of it is that you also run across a number of references to books like the book of Jashar, J-A-S-H-A-R, or the books of the Acts of Solomon, for example. Books that are not in the Bible, or writings that are not in the Bible, and as far as we know, have not been kept. And that is the thing I noticed, like even in reading the cards that you guys wrote at the start of this series, that's the thing that puzzles us. Does that mean then that there's some things that we needed to have that have been lost? And does it mean that the things that are in the Bible are just sort of there willy-nilly by the will of men? That's the part of this story that we're going to try to pursue starting next week. So hope everybody will plan to be with us for that. Thanks for your presence today.